The Tom Woods Show, episode 439.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Hello, everybody. It's Tom Woods, and today we're going to talk about Afghanistan. A lot of people talk about the Iraq War, and they say what a disaster that was, but Afghanistan gets partly a pass. Also, I think there are libertarians out there who are against the war in Afghanistan, but just don't really know very many details about it. It's a war, so they're going to be against it. But let's fill in some of these gaps, and joining us to talk about this is our friend Ray McGovern. Ray McGovern is a retired CIA officer. He was a CIA analyst from 1963 to 1990. In the 1980s, he chaired national intelligence estimates and prepared the president's daily brief. He was responsible for the analysis of Soviet policy in Vietnam. He received the Intelligence Commendation Medal at his retirement, but he returned it in 2006 in protest at the CIA's involvement in torture. In 2003, he co-founded Veteran Intelligence Professionals for Sanity. Find out more about Ray at raymcgovern.com. Ray, welcome back.
Thank you, Tom.
As I told you before we went on, I'm interested in talking about Afghanistan because of the number of people who seem to be of the opinion, along with the president, I might add, that although we can all see what a disaster the war in Iraq turned out to be, we have to prosecute the war in Afghanistan because that was the good war, so to speak, in the war on terror. And that, after all, what else could we do, given that this was the headquarters of Osama bin Laden? He had taken up residence there. He was being protected by the regime there. And after what happened on 9/11, what else could we do but invade Afghanistan and try to clear out all the terrorist training camps? I mean, this is what people read in the New York Times, and I perfectly well understand why they would hold such a view. But I would suspect that your view is that the reality is a little bit more nuanced than this.
Well, it is, Tom. And whether the New York Times really had that view or not, it was really proceeding from talking points from the White House, which it did for the entire time from 9/11 until today. When you say that Osama bin Laden or the Al-Qaeda terrorists were being protected by Afghanistan, well, we didn't really quite get that. We got that from the New York Times, but it isn't quite right. The regime in Kabul, the Taliban, offered Osama bin Laden. They offered him on a silver platter to the United States. All they required, as is their custom, was proof that Osama bin Laden was behind the attacks on 9/11. That request was dusted off because we were hell-bent on attacking Afghanistan as a kind of warm-up. Yeah, right, as a kind of warm-up for Iraq. It's very clear that on the evening of 9/11, Bush already showed his hand that they were going to use this to attack Iraq. So it was kind of a warm-up, and the rationale adduced, we had to make sure that Al-Qaeda or terrorism in general would have no place to operate from, would have no base. Well, that was a canard from the word one. My former colleague, Paul Pilar, was about as senior as you can get on the analyst side of the CIA, wrote very clearly that it doesn't have to do with having space. And actually, 9/11 was not plotted from Afghanistan. It was rather plotted from Germany, Spain, and flight schools in the United States. Okay? And so he put, the issue is not preventing such a haven. That was the big thing. We can't have a haven for Afghanistan. That wasn't the issue, says Paul. It was a matter of a balance here, thwarting the creation of a fiscal haven in one country. Was that going to do the trick? Well, look at the situation now. It's not that you attack one country, because by attacking one country, you encourage the spread of these people, and now they're all over the place, right? Now they have their own quasi-country in the center of Syria and Iraq. So there must have been other motives for President Obama to go and surge, as the saying goes, in Afghanistan. Now, Obama thought he was really clever. He wanted to be sort of like Lincoln. So he picked the worst of the worst for his advisors. Robert Gates, for example, who had been head of the Defense Department under Bush, he asked him to stay on. And, of course, he lauded people like David Petraeus, the fellow with the 10 rows of medals and merit badges, to the skies. But when he asked them for options, what to do about Afghanistan, and he asked specifically for one option to draw down, well, Robert Gates forgot to give him that option. In other words, by leaks to the press and by pressure in the White House, these people succeeded in sort of mousetrapping the president into doubling down in a fool's errand.
So you mean this was not Obama's natural instinct, but that he was more or less cornered into this?
That's exactly right. Now, Obama, that doesn't speak very well for a very weak president, does it? But, you know, if you look back to the time when, in early 2009, when he was seized with what to do about the deteriorating situation in Afghanistan, what did he do? Well, he appointed a fellow named Bruce Rydell from Brookings Institute, and then he sort of orchestrated this study. And when he came out to announce that he was going to send 20,000 more troops there in sort of a quasi-surge to be supplemented later that year by 30,000 more, the president was 20 minutes late in making the announcement. Why? Because just hours before, there had been Afghan soldiers that had shot up U.S. soldiers. There had been other terrorist events. And I dare say, my surmise is that Obama was saying, do I really want to do this? Do I really want to let the military and people like Bruce Rydell from Brookings sort of mousetrap me into this? So in the event, he was 20 minutes late. And when he came out, of course, he said all the rhetorical things. But that was, you know, that was doubling down on a fool's errand. Look at the situation now. Has it improved any? No. If the objective was to stem terrorism, has that been stemmed? Of course not. Paul Pillar was right. You don't do this by closing down Al-Qaeda in one country. So in a very sorrowful sense, we've lost over 2,000 men and women in Afghanistan. There's no end in sight. And when Obama commissioned the second review later in 2009, he got some good advice from General Carl Eikenberry. Now, who's Eikenberry? Well, he had been in charge of U.S. forces in Afghanistan. He had also been in charge of training Afghan troops. And unlike Petraeus, he was not going to pretend that he had trained crackerjack Afghan troops. No, he said that this was really not the way to go. They could not be trained to kill their cousins. He also said that Hamid Karzai, the president of Afghanistan, was not a, quote, reliable partner, end quote. He also said that if you think that you can dissuade the Pakistanis from supporting the terrorists in Afghanistan, you don't know anything about how the Pakistanis look at their primary objectives, which always and everywhere are to stem Indian influence. And so they're not about to desist in Afghanistan as long as there's the slightest chance that India could become the major power there as it has in the past. So Eikenberry warned Obama about all this. And how do we know this? Well, some gutsy soul, and I don't know who it was, leaked two cables from November of 2009 to the New York Times. And there Eikenberry sets out the whole rationale. But Obama was not strong enough politically to accept his sensible recommendations. What happened was Eikenberry came back. He made nice with everybody else. And indeed, to his discredit, but very much in keeping with the senior military. He went up on the Hill, he went to Congress, and he argued for this course in Afghanistan, which he already told the president was a fool's errand. That's the kind of thing you get in Afghanistan. And, you know, when you look at it in historical terms, well, let me just say a word about the first fellow that tried to pacify Afghanistan, or at least get through it to China. His name was Alexander the Great. Now, Tom, do you know why they call him the Great? It was because when he started taking numerous casualties on his flanks from these Afghan tribes who don't understand that Alexander was just there to help them, right? And they didn't understand that, you know, when people invade your country, they mean well. And so he called a council of his elders and his senior generals, and they looked at the mountains between Afghanistan and China, and they looked at the casualties that they already had suffered, and they said, you know, maybe we ought to go back to Central. Why don't we go back to the Middle East where we know what we're doing? And they did. Now, that's why they call him the Great. What happened after that? Well, we had a series of the Indians, the French, the British, the Americans, the Russians. Everybody tried to subdue Afghanistan. Nobody knew what they were doing. We're not going to be able to succeed in doing that either.
What about this Taliban regime? What can you tell us about them? Because it seems that as time went on, we started to see headlines that were getting us used to the idea that the U.S. may in some way have to collaborate with these people after all.
Well, actually, that is realpolitik. That is what's going to have to happen. The sooner we come up to that and face up to it, the better. But the Taliban, you know, has a checkered history. Back in the late 90s, they came to Houston, and they got a very nice warm letter from then Governor George W. Bush. Why were they in Houston? Because there were plans for the TAPI natural gas pipeline. That's Turkmenistan, Afghanistan, Pakistan, and India. This was a pipeline that had been engineered, was on the books. Why Turkmenistan? Because Turkmenistan has more natural gas, well, let's put it this way, that natural gas worth more than all the oil in Iraq, okay? The problem is you can't get here from there. And so they had this Caspian Sea pipeline, which would take that gas, as I said, through Afghanistan, Pakistan, and India, and it would be called the TAPI pipeline. Now, that was on the books. Khalidzad, the U.S. ambassador later in both Kabul and Iraq, was one of the prime movers. Well, I asked him 10 years later at a public forum, I said, what happened to the TAPI pipeline? He said, well, there's too much violence there now. It doesn't look like it's going to work out. And then I was removed before I could ask him a follow-up question like, is that why we stay in Afghanistan? Is that why all U.S. troops are pretty much all are positioned along the route that the pipeline was going to take? So there's that as well. There's the interest in their natural resources. That's not going to work out. So it's time we fold our tent like Arabs do and silently steal away.
What do you think would have to happen? What would the situation in Afghanistan have to look like before the U.S. government would say, we're actually satisfied with the situation now, so we can withdraw with honor? What would it have to look like?
Let's face facts, Tom. There is no withdrawing with honor. We can try to disguise the withdrawal, and the mainstream press here in this country will cooperate in that. But what needs to happen is what always happened in the past. Now, I'm old enough to remember that when you get an international conflict like this with such ramifications, what you do is you convene the stakeholders. You bring them to Geneva or to Paris or to Vienna. You sit them around the table and you say, all right, look, none of us want this to get completely out of hand. All of us have some interest in stopping the bloodletting. let's see if we can make a deal, okay? And that would include Russia, it would include China, it would include Iran, it would include all the Middle Eastern countries, Iran especially, because they suffer greatly from especially from the drug trade from Afghanistan. So that's what needs to happen. Will anybody get their maximum demands? No, but that's what a negotiation is all about. It would stop the bloodletting, and it would give Afghanistan a reasonable chance to have a more peaceful future than is in the cards the way things stand now.
So in other words, diplomacy before the last, 30 years or so, the way it used to be handled, the way it was handled at the Congress of Vienna, or the way it would have been handled in almost any other situation, is that you bring the great powers together and you hash it out.
Yeah, even on Vietnam, we began talks in Paris, and after a while, we were able to work it out. So it's very odd to me, Tom, that this is the last option considered. And, I've been trying to figure out for the last several years what lies behind these U.S. policies. Now, it seems to me that an oversimplification would say, well, it's either one, stupidity, a complete lack of knowledge of what goes on in that part of the world, and the ability of U.S. to influence things. And as my colleague from the FBI, Colleen Rowley, keeps reminding me, look, Ray, there's no underestimating the stupidity of the bureaucracy in Washington. Okay, that's number one. The second is more sinister. And I'm beginning to believe that, my aversion to saying U.S. imperialism, well, I didn't want to sound like a nutcase, right? But, when you think of General Eisenhower, President Eisenhower, warning us as he left office about what he called the military-industrial complex, and your listeners probably would like to know that he wanted to include congressional. So what he wanted to say was, I warn about the military-industrial congressional complex, which left unrestrained will cause havoc. Okay, now what did he mean? Well, what he meant quite simply was that peace is really bad for business, Tom. I mean, there's no gainsaying the fact that peace is bad for business. Now, war or tensions such as we have in the Ukraine now are very good for business, okay? So what am I saying? I'm saying that the corporate interests here, which profiteer, I'm not saying profit, I'm saying profiteer on wars. Take Halliburton, take all the big firms that made billions, not millions, but billions on the war in Iraq. Well, they're still around. They're still profiteering. And Obama does not seem able to call them out and to restrain them. Take, for example, the rise of ISIS, okay? Now, ISIS is a prime example of what Paul Pillar was warning about. Now, they didn't need to be in Afghanistan. And so there they are in Iraq and Syria. They have their quasi-state. And what happens? A year ago, the crack and the crackerjack Iraqi troops that General Petraeus armed and trained, 300,000 of them, what did they do when ISIS shot a couple of AK-47s in their direction in northern Iraq? They ran away. They ran away, Tom. Okay, well, I exaggerate. They didn't all run away. The officers took helicopters out of the area. Okay, now what happened to the weapons? What happened to the tanks and the artillery pieces and the armored personnel carriers? What happened? They left them on the field. Whoa. And so what did the U.S. military, U.S. Air Force have to do? Well, you can't let them fall into the hands of ISIL, right, or ISIS, so you have to destroy them. So they bombed the heck out of the U.S. military-provided equipment. And now what are they doing? Oh, well, you have to replenish the supplies in Baghdad, right? And so billions and billions of more equipment are being given to the very fragile, inept regime in Baghdad. So, hey, look, part of those profits go into the pockets of congressmen and senators who are running for office. They are guaranteed victory because they have all manner of wealth to devote to TV ads and everything else. So it's a really, is this a great country or what? I mean, you appropriate the money, right? The military-industrial congressional complex makes huge profits. You take part of those profits, you give them to the candidates who have to run every 2 or every 6 years, and they get reelected and they appropriate more money. I mean, is this a great country or what?
Allow me to offer a friendly amendment to one thing that you said.
Sure.
You said that peace is bad for business and war is good for business. Well, maybe it's that peace is very, very good for businesses that actually make a real contribution to society, who produce things that you and I couldn't live without. Peace is exactly what they want. They want stability, and they want uninterrupted flows of supplies so that they can provide the things that you and I need. It is the businesses that are connected to this complex that, as you say, do benefit from it. And I think it doesn't sound crazy to say that they benefit from it. I think it would be incredibly naive to think that given there's a massive opportunity to supply huge quantities of military equipment, and given that cost is not always the top priority when it comes to the Pentagon, it would be crazy not to think that people think this way, and they think in terms of these profits, and that politicians always wind up doing very well. I always wonder, Ray, why it is or how it is that some politician who came out of nowhere, like Dennis Hastert would be an example. I mean, I can think of really almost anybody. A lot of them are nobodies when they start out, and then after they leave office, they are multimillionaires. I mean, something happened in between there. I'm not quite sure what it is.
You know, Tom, I've thought about this a lot. This happens not only in Congress, but would you believe it, among senior officials of the intelligence community. Now, what happened to all those senior intelligence officials like George Tenet, head of the CIA, who deliberately lied to get us into Iraq? And again, I would warn your listeners, this was not a mistake. This was fraud. Bush wanted to make a war. He said to George Tenet, head of the CIA, dig up some evidence, in quotes, that will justify this war. And he did. Now, where is he? At Wall Street. Where is the head of analysis in those days? She's on Wall Street. Where is Mike Morrell, who is the deputy? He's working for Wall Street. And so my appeal would be, let's pass a law that says if you want to be a top intelligence official, you have to forego working for Wall Street once you leave. Pretty simple. You can't do that in Congress, obviously, but you might be able to do that because it makes such eminent good sense in the intelligence community.
Ray, tell me exactly why the U.S. can't win in Afghanistan. It's one thing to say we've had all these great powers that have tried their hand at it and have failed, but a typical member of the neocon electorate would say, we could just flatten the country. We could win if we really wanted to win. And certainly we can't leave if there are terrorists still there. So we've got to just keep on keeping on. Why is that not possible? Why can't it be done? It seems people are frustrated that the U.S. seems to be impotent. It's supposed to be the great indispensable nation, and it can't win in Afghanistan. Why can't it win exactly?
Well, Tom, it could win if it were prepared to do what we try to do in Vietnam with the villages, you know, destroy them to save them from communism. Now, we can destroy Afghanistan to save it from insurgents or terrorists. But, you know, that would take, well, the easy way to do that would be to use small nuclear weapons. Now, I don't think anybody is going to suggest that. Now, I'm a former Army intelligence and infantry officer, and I know that no matter how many troops, 500,000 if you wish, you insert into Afghanistan, you're not going to be able, number one, to persuade Afghans to kill their cousins, and number two, you're not going to be able to subdue what these people, these very, very fierce people, the Pashtuns and the others, that feel it is their sacred ground. So we learned that, I thought, in Vietnam. And you can't win. One of the things that is never mentioned, and this comes out of my infantry training, is that you need secure locks, okay? Now, I'm from New York, but I'm not talking about bagels and locks. I'm talking about LOCS, lines of communication and supply. No one, from the smallest squad leader to the division commander, should enter battle without having secure locks, lines of communication, and supply. Now, I don't know why Petraeus and those other guys? Maybe they didn't go to Fort Benning like I did, but why they didn't look at the map, for God's sake, and see what it would take to supply an army over those mountains from Pakistan into Afghanistan. The ships go from the West Coast, they go to Karachi, they unload, they go on trucks through the Khyber Pass and other passes down into Afghanistan. They're sitting ducks for insurgents. And by the time a gallon of gasoline gets to Kabul, it costs $600, okay? Now, granted, Americans think that we have unlimited means. I don't believe that's the case. But the money is not the problem. It's just physically impossible. And now we have a situation where we had persuaded the Russians to let us use the back door to exit or to insert military equipment via the Trans-Siberian Railroad. Well, they've closed that off. So where do we stand? We stand in a feckless position that any infantry officer should have known would not work when you don't have secure locks, secure lines of communication and supply. So unless you're prepared to nuke them, it's not going to work no matter how many hundreds of thousands of troops you put in there. And we should have known that from Vietnam.
One last thing, Ray. Suppose you were in charge after 9/11. I'm sure people have objected in this way. Well, what would you have done, Mr. Smarty Pants?
Well, I certainly wouldn't have appealed to the basest instincts of the American people. Revenge. I would have said, let's think about this, American people. Why? No one asks why. Well, I'm going to tell you why, American people. Why do they hate us? Well, I lied when I said they hate our democracy, that they hate our freedom. That was made up by my speechwriters. What they hate is our policies. They hate our support for dictators like those in Saudi Arabia and Bahrain and Pakistan. And they hate the fact that, as our policymakers describe it, there is, quote, no daylight between the foreign policies of Israel on the one hand and the foreign policies of Washington on the other. And so if you look for the reasons why they did this, you need to address the U.S. policies that, in the final analysis, are responsible for why they hate us. Now, John Brennan, my CIA head, has implied that Muslims come out of the womb after their first scream. They say, I hate America, I hate America. Well, fellow Americans, they're not hardwired to hate America. They don't hate America because of what we stand for. They hate America for what we do. What we do to the Palestinians and what we do to other people who are oppressed by these dictatorial Saudi and other regimes to whom we sell the arms, enabling them to suppress. So, you know, it's really a little bit more complicated than hating our freedoms or hating our democracy. We need to address the causes. And for you Americans who need a simple analogy, let me just tell you that the way to defeat terrorism is the same way that you defeat malaria. Okay, this is a stretch. Well, let me explain. How do you defeat malaria? Well, what you do is you find out where the mosquitoes are, right? And you trace them back to where they breed, okay? The swamp where they breed. And then what you do is you station three platoons of sharpshooters around that swamp and you try to shoot all the mosquitoes that they leave, right? Wrong. What do? You drain the swamp. Now, what's the analogy? These terrorists, so-called, breed in a swamp of grievances that is deeper than any swamp you can imagine. And so if you want to stop terrorism, you need to drain the swamp of those grievances and not appear to be exasperating situations under which they have to exist, but rather ameliorating them. And so that's the answer, my fellow Americans. We're going to sell less weapons. We're going to sell more clean air, clean water things to these folks in hopes that over the years they'll forget our policies of the past and realize that we'd like to have a better world for all citizens.
I'm inclined in that direction myself, but I want to at least raise the other side's argument, which would be that it may be. Now, I'm going to present the other side's argument as reasonably as I can. I've never heard it presented quite this way. Maybe it's possible they could concede that, yes, U.S. government policy has made things worse in terms of these people's attitudes toward the United States. And yes, as recently as the mid-20th century, the United States had an excellent reputation throughout the Middle East. They were not viewed as being dishonest brokers, but as being a model for other people. After World War I, Syria wanted to be governed, when its people were consulted, they wanted to be governed by the United States as a League of Nations mandate. That would be inconceivable today that they would think that. So obviously something changed, and what seems to have changed was the policy. But on the other hand, you could say that in the intervening years, there was another phenomenon happening simultaneously, that Wahhabism was on the rise, radical Islam is on the rise, and there are people who seem to be against the West no matter what the West does. So it seems to be hard to disentangle these two ingredients, the grievances and the radicalism.
Well, Tom, that's well presented. Problem, as I see it, is that the radicalism in large measure comes from the grievances. And, you know, people are totally confused with respect to who the U.S. is supporting in the Middle East right now. Are we supporting the people trying to overthrow Assad in Syria? Do we really want ISIS to be in control of Syria? Or do we pretty much want Assad? And do we think that the Saudi-Israeli alliance, which is what it amounts to now, is a good thing for what they're doing in Yemen? It's totally confusing. But what I would suggest is this. There's a very simple syllogism that explains this or can explain it. And that is, major premise, U.S. and Israeli policy are identical in that part of the world. Minor premise, Israel, as it has said, sees its preferred outcome in Syria, for example, as, quote, no outcome, end quote. And they explain that as long as the Sunni and Shia are killing each other off, Israel feels more secure. Conclusion, what you see in terms of the variegated, the inconsistent U.S. policy toward that whole area can be explained by the overweening desire by Israel that there be no outcome to the hostilities that exist there. That's the only thing that makes any sense to me. And when you talk about what motivates terrorists, well, they caught Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, right? He was the inspiration, the mastermind, as they say, behind 9/11. And, you know, when they caught him, the 9/11 Commission study was nearing completion. And, you know, I know some of the young people on that staff, and they say, hey, wow, we caught him. We're supposed to find out why they did it. Let's ask them. Well, of course, the CIA would not let them ask him, so the CIA asked them. And on page 147 of the 9/11 Commission report, you get what Khalid Sheikh Mohammed told his interrogators. Now, the background here is that he has an engineering degree from the University of North Carolina in Greensboro, okay? So the initial thought was, oh, maybe he had an affair of the heart that went bad, or maybe people call him a towelhead or something in Greensboro. Well, no, this is a quote from page 147. Quote, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed's animus toward the United States stemmed not from any experience he had as a student in the United States, but from his deep hatred for U.S. policy favoring Israel, period, end quote. Now, why didn't they try this guy in New York? Because he might have said that. Why do they have him in Guantanamo? Because they can keep his mouth shut there. That's a little bit too simple, but it goes a long way toward explaining why people like Khalid Sheikh Mohammed and his nephew before him, who was responsible for the attacks on the Twin Towers in 93, why they have said that the animosity that they feel toward U.S. support for Israel lies behind a large part of their motivation in their terrorist activities.
Ray, before I let you go, I want to tell you one thing I appreciate about what you're doing in particular. You take a distinctly nonpartisan approach to what is obviously a bipartisan problem. I was thinking back as we were talking to a remark I heard that had been made by Bill Kristol, the king of the neocons, back in 2009, after the president had apparently given a speech on Afghanistan in March of that year. He was asked by a staffer at the Weekly Standard what he thought about the speech, and his response was, "All hail Obama." You know, we're just in big trouble when we get to that point that Bill Kristol is saying, "All hail Obama." The problem goes beyond one person or one party. It's the whole regime that has given us this disaster of a policy. And I'm grateful that we have truth tellers out there like Ray McGovern. And I'm grateful for your time this morning. Thank you, Ray.
You're most welcome, Tom.
All right, everybody. Remember, tomwoods.com/439 is the show notes page for today, and we're going to include an article by Ray McGovern that covers some of the material that we were talking about today. Before I fill you in on what's coming up next week, it's July right now, July 2015, as I record this. So we are getting close to the time when families are thinking about what they're going to do in terms of homeschooling for the coming year. Do please consider the Ron Paul homeschool curriculum, which I have created courses for. I've created hundreds and hundreds of videos on history and government. Check out ronpaulhomeschool.com, and if you enter the site through ronpaulhomeschool.com, you'll be taken right to a page that'll tell you all about the curriculum. And also, if you enter through ronpaulhomeschool.com, I'll give you two freebies if you just write to me and ask for them at tomwoods.com on my contact page. The first one is a signed copy of my New York Times best-selling book, The Politically Incorrect Guide to American History. And secondly, a free 10-lesson bonus course suitable for junior high and above to get your junior high age students excited about a liberty-based curriculum. It's a course on the foundations of liberty, and that's also yours free if you go through ronpaulhomeschool.com. That way I can track to see how well this whole promotion is going. It has to be ronpaulhomeschool.com, and then from there just go ahead and sign up. And then drop me a line, and I'll be glad to send you both of those items. All right, so what's coming up the rest of the week? Tomorrow we're going to be talking to Vít Jedlička, who is the president of Liberland, you may have heard of, a new libertarian country that's being created. I know you think I'm joking, but I'm not. This is a real thing. You may have read about it. Very, very interesting conversation you will not want to miss. And speaking of not wanting to miss something, Wednesday we talk to Ron Paul about his brand new book, Swords into Plowshares, A Life in Wartime and a Future of Peace and Prosperity. You can check out that book, by the way, it's called Swords into Plowshares. You can check it out at tomwoods.com/swords. Very much worth reading. Then Thursday, we're going to talk about what's going on in Greece. Total fiasco there, and I know there are some listeners who have followed it a little bit but don't really know the whole story, so this will be like Greece 101 for you. Nick Giambruno will come back to talk to us about that. And then on Friday, we'll be talking about sound money with Larry Parks. And then next week, we're going to have a show on Bernie Sanders. It's just going to be great. So make sure and listen to the instruction here at the end of the show where it tells you to subscribe to the show. Make sure and do that, because how devastated would you be if you missed one of these episodes? Thanks for listening, everybody.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit tomwoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.